Chapter 6 The War Machine. If I were to ask the average person, what objective information would make you believe that one country is a military threat and another is not? What response do you think I'd get? Most people would probably answer with something along the lines of, tell me how much money that country is spending on its military compared to other countries, and I'll know which country is most interested in either conflict or enforcing its will on other countries. According to the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, in 2022, the United States spent $877 billion on defense. Authors note, they use a broader, but they claim more accurate, measure of defense spending than other sources, although the difference between other sources is less than 10%. By comparison, the top 10 militaries after the United States spend only $849 billion. According to Statista, in 2021, this was the military spending of the top 10 militaries after the United States. China spent $293 billion. India spent $76.6 billion. The United Kingdom spent $68.4 billion. Russia spent $65.9 billion. France spent $56.6 billion. Germany spent $56 billion. Saudi Arabia spent $55.6 billion. Japan spent $54.1 billion. South Korea spent $50.2 billion. Italy spent $32 billion. Australia spent $31 billion. How is it that the United States can spend $877 billion on defense, and the next nine countries combined spend only $849 billion? Is this a legitimate use of money for defense, or is there a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse going into the U.S. number? And what about the money going into our intelligence agencies and their black budgets? An analysis for the Institute for Policy Studies found, even amid the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic, world military spending hit record levels, said Dr. Diego Lopez da Silva, senior researcher with SIPRI's Military Expenditure and Arms Production Program. There was a slowdown in the rate of real terms growth due to inflation. In nominal terms, however, military spending grew by 6.1%. The United States still makes up the lion's share, with its $801 billion in 2021, representing 39% of the world's military spending. Authors note, we have 4% of the world's population. While Russia increased its military spending by 2.9%, to $65.9 billion during a period when it was militarizing the border with Ukraine, that pales in comparison to what the United States and NATO allied countries are spending combined, nearly $1.2 trillion, more than 17 times what Russia spent. That failed to dissuade Putin's aggression toward Ukraine. It's almost as if military spending is not the key to peace. It's one thing to make the argument that this money is being spent to enforce the peace, but when it seems to make no difference in Putin's aggression toward Ukraine or the current face-off with China over Taiwan, it's critical to revisit one's assumptions. Does our military exist to ensure a more peaceful world, or is it to keep the defense contractors employed? Since we have a revolving door of former generals and admirals working for the defense industries, as well as former intelligence agents, is it reasonable to question whether they have been working on a less-than-patriotic agenda? I know that this line of argument from me will be confusing to people who are not familiar with my views. The mainstream media would have you believe I am a guy who wants the citizens and our nation armed to the teeth, willing to use that military force whenever we like. Nothing could be further from the truth. I was one of the loudest voices against the war in Iraq Obama going into Syria, and how NATO expansion has pushed Putin over Russia's red line and left him believing there was no other choice but to invade Ukraine. Does that make me an apologist for Putin? Not in the slightest. I have no hesitation in telling you that Putin is a gangster, a killer, and a thug. But he's not nearly as interested in foreign adventures as is the United States. We like to go everywhere. At this moment, the United States has approximately 750 bases in 80 countries, according to the Cato Institute. From the Cato Institute commentary, a new Quincy Institute study by American University's David Vine and World Beyond War's Patterson Deppen and Lee Bulger details the global U.S. military presence. Washington has nearly three times as many bases as embassies and consulates. America also has three times as many installations as all other countries combined. The United Kingdom has 145, Russia 2 to 3 dozen, China 5. Although the number of U.S. facilities has fallen in half since the end of the Cold War, the number of nations hosting American bases has doubled. Washington is as willing to station forces in undemocratic as democratic countries. The study figures the annual cost of this expansive base structure to be about $55 billion. Adding increased personnel expenses takes the total up to $80 billion. Wealthier countries, which needlessly enjoy what amounts to defense welfare, typically cover a portion of the cost through host nation support. Not so with Washington's newest clients. Indeed, through the global war on terror over the last two decades, the U.S. military spent as much as $100 billion on new construction, mostly in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, which were financial black holes. Is the perspective you have as a consumer of American media that the United States has three times the number of bases as we do embassies and consulates? I doubt you had even the slightest idea about that number, or that the United Kingdom would be in second with 145 bases. But then again, they did used to have the British Empire. But with 750 bases in 80 countries, one has to ask the question, didn't World War II end 78 years ago? And do these bases ensure peace, or just endless wars? The Cato Institute commentary continued. Perhaps the most serious price of endless bases has been endless wars. Obviously, causation is complex. However, going to war usually leads to the creation of new facilities. Such installations encourage a continuing military presence. Existence of nearby bases reduces the marginal cost of intervening and increases the maximal temptation to make new commitments, meddle in local controversies, and enter nearby conflicts. Observed the Quincy study, since 1980, U.S. bases in the greater Middle East have been used at least 25 times to launch wars or other combat operations in at least 15 countries in that region alone. Since 2001, the U.S. military has been involved in combat in at least 25 countries worldwide. Talk about not respecting borders. The average person would probably say, okay, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. That's three. What are the other 22 countries? Do you have any idea? The reason you probably don't is that our military likes to hide a lot of what it does because it knows you would object. Alas, DOD is less than forthcoming about the number of bases it maintains overseas. According to the report, until fiscal year 2018, the Pentagon produced and published an annual report in accordance with U.S. law. Even when it produced this report, the Pentagon produced incomplete or inaccurate data, failing to document dozens of well-known installations. For example, the Pentagon has long claimed it has only one base in Africa, Djibouti. But research shows that there are now around 40 installations of varying sizes on the continent. One military official acknowledged 46 installations in 2017. When there is a media blackout of this information, how can the average American make an informed decision about our military? How can our elected representatives make responsible decisions when such information is kept from them? The simple answer is they cannot. And the only group that benefits from this public ignorance is the military contractor intelligence complex. You don't know to be concerned about the number of military bases around the globe. Don't blame yourself because you didn't know. The news media didn't inform you. I will. Feel free to check all my sources. A casual observer might think to themselves, okay, so we're spending a lot of money, and we have a lot of military bases overseas. I get that. But at least we're making sure we have the weapons, and the bad guys don't, right? That's wrong. We make sure the bad guys get weapons as well. This is an article from The Intercept on May 11, 2023, about U.S. arms sales in 2022. Since the end of the Cold War, the United States has been the world's biggest weapons dealer, accounting for 40% of all arms exports in a given year. In general, these exports are funded through grants or sales. There are two pathways for the latter category: foreign military sales, FMS, and direct commercial sales, DCS. The U.S. government acts as an intermediary for FMS acquisitions. It buys the material from a company first, and then delivers the goods to the foreign recipient. DCS acquisitions are more straightforward. They're the result of an agreement between a U.S. company and a foreign government. Both categories of sales require the government's approval. The United States is about 4% of the world's population, and yet we sell 40% of the world's weapons. And that's assuming that the figures we're being provided by our military aren't underestimates of what they're actually doing. And to whom are they selling? Country-level data for last year's DCS authorization was released in late April through the State Department's Directorate of Defense Trade Controls. FMS figures for fiscal year 2022 were released earlier this year. According to their data, a total of 142 countries bought weapons from the U.S. in 2022 for a total of $85 billion in bilateral trade. Of the 84 countries classified as autocracies under the regimes of the world system in 2022, the United States sold weapons to at least 48, or 57% of them. The at least qualifier is necessary because several factors frustrate the accurate tracking of U.S. weapons sales. The State Department's report of commercial arms sales during the fiscal year makes prodigious use of various in its recipient categories. As a result, the specific recipients for nearly $11 billion in weapons sales are not disclosed. Again, we, the American public, are prevented from having accurate information, and the information that is released somehow never becomes a subject for public discussion among our mainstream news media. And if some commentator does mention these facts, it's usually to say something along the lines of, well, it doesn't seem like Americans object to these actions. It's difficult to object when you don't know these actions are taking place. And this has been a truly bipartisan effort, with Biden being just as profligate as Trump. Despite the rhetoric, a review of new data suggests instead of business-as-usual approach to weapons sales, former President Donald Trump based his arms sales policy primarily on economic considerations, corporate interests above all else. In his first foreign trip as president, he traveled to Saudi Arabia and announced a major arms deal with the repressive kingdom. Trump's business-first approach resulted in a dramatic upturn in weapons sales during his administration. In Biden's first full fiscal year as president, weapons sales from the United States to other countries reached $206 billion, according to the State Department's annual tally, which uses an opaque but seemingly broader accounting of yearly FMS and DCS figures. Biden's first year total surpasses the Trump-era high of $192 billion. The multi-billion-dollar effort to train and equip Ukraine doesn't fully explain the dramatic rise in total arms sales last year, let alone autocracies. This slavish devotion to the military-industrial intelligence complex has to come to an end. While there's much I'll praise about Trump, when it comes to military spending, he was just as bad as any of them. Yes, I've heard the claim that you need to feed the military before you can make any changes, but that seems a recipe for madness. It seems the military just gets fed, and no changes ever occur. As I look at the more than two decades since the 9/11 attacks, all I see is wasted money and lives. The only people who've done well have been the military contractors. This article from 2021 totals the financial and human cost of the United States military adventures since 2001. The U.S.-led global war on terror has killed nearly 1 million people globally and cost more than $8 trillion since it began two decades ago. These staggering figures come from a landmark report issued Wednesday by Brown University's Costs of War Project, an ongoing research effort to document the economic and human impact of post-9/11 military operations. The report, which looks at the tolls of wars waged in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, and other regions where the U.S. is militarily engaged, is the latest in a series published by the Costs of Wars Project and provides the most extensive public accounting to date of the consequences of open-ended U.S. conflicts in the Middle East, Central Asia, and Africa, referred to today as the Forever Wars. After the attacks of 9/11, were there a million terrorists we needed to kill? It's estimated the 9/11 attacks cost approximately $250,000 to plan. Did we need to spend $8 trillion to ensure that similar attacks didn't happen in the future? Despite futuristic drone technology, the simple fact is that the global war on terror has been an amazingly blunt and indiscriminate tool in seeking to eliminate radical Islamic terrorism. Our adversaries are generally not military forces, which group themselves for attacks on the continental United States, but villagers living in remote regions of the globe where they may hold anti-American views without ever having a realistic chance of ever meeting a genuine American. What is perhaps inexcusable for any civilized country to do is engage in a protracted conflict in many nations, without expending much energy in determining our level of effectiveness or the misery we may be inflicting on these regions. The question of how many people have lost their lives in the post-9/11 conflicts has been the subject of ongoing debate, though the numbers in all cases have been extraordinarily high. Previous costs of wars studies have put death toll figures in the hundreds of thousands, an estimate tallying those directly killed by violence. According to a 2015 estimate from the Nobel Prize-winning Physicians for Social Responsibility, well over 1 million have been killed both directly and indirectly in wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan alone. The difficulty of calculating death tolls is made harder by the U.S. military's own refusal to keep track of the number of people killed in its operations, as well as the remoteness of the regions where many of these conflicts take place. If our news media genuinely brought these issues to the attention of the American people, there would be outrage and a demand that we wind down the machinations of the war machine. But the public is kept in a calculated state of ignorance about these matters. All they know is that the military actions continue without end. They don't seem to produce results, and yet every year, the military contractors make more and more money, snapping up retired generals and admirals like hoarders at a flea market, who more than earn their pay by getting their former colleagues in the military to buy more and more weapons. The article continued. Many will find the astronomical financial cost of the global war on terror galling, not just because of how relatively little it has produced in return, but also because of the discrepancy between what the current price tag of the wars has run and what U.S. officials initially claimed would be required. The war in Iraq provides one sobering example. In September 2002, Lawrence Lindsay, then chief economic advisor under President George W. Bush, estimated that the upper bound expenses for the looming invasion and occupation would run between $100 and $200 billion. Later that year, Mitch Daniels, then director of the Office of Management and Budget, provided an even more humble estimate of the costs, saying that war in Iraq would likely run U.S. taxpayers between $50 and $60 billion. It's been frustrating in the years since Obama took office that I've been considered a right-winger, when during the Bush years I was something of a darling among the left-wingers, not just for my anti-war activism, but also for my campaign against the World Trade Organization, another protest movement that mysteriously disappeared when masked agitators, hello, baby Antifa, started showing up at protests and causing violence. In my mind, I'm neither right nor left. I'm a truth winger. I like to think of myself as an umpire, calling balls and strikes as I see them. A commentator who does his work without fear of favoritism, as the canons of journalism tell us to do. Where are the people of integrity in the government? It seems that all the politicians, the bureaucrats, the generals and admirals, and military industrial intelligence contractors are just pigs at the trough, and we're the ones stuck paying for the feed. How much waste is in the United States defense budget? And what exactly are we getting for the hundreds of billions of dollars we spend annually on the military? One of the places you might look is a report from 2022 by the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Here are just a few of the ways in which the American taxpayers are being robbed. Overcharging the Pentagon for spare parts has a long and inglorious history, reaching its previous peak of public visibility during the presidency of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Then, blanket media coverage of $640 toilet seats and $7,600 coffee makers sparked public outrage and a series of hearings on Capitol Hill, strengthening the backbone of members of Congress. In those years, they did indeed curb at least the worst excess of the Reagan military buildup. Regardless of our political persuasions, can we at least agree that military contractors don't seem to have the best track record for honest dealing? I'd like to say that some of the rules under which the military buys parts are crazy, but that might give crazy a bad name. Here's an example. A recent POGO, Project on Governmental Oversight Analysis, for instance, documented the malfeasance of TransDyne, a military parts supplier that the Department of Defense's Inspector General caught overcharging the Pentagon by as much as 3,800%. Yes, you heard that right, on routine items. The company was able to do so only because, bizarrely enough, Pentagon buying rules prevent contract officers from getting accurate information on what any given item should cost or might cost the supplying company to produce it. Even the most profligate shopper in our country understands the concept of comparing the cost of materials and labor into an approximation of what the finished product might cost. And even if they couldn't acquire that information, they'd know to go to 2 or 3 stores, maybe check online, to understand whether or not they're getting a good deal. This is our government spending your tax dollars, and the rules, put in by the military contractors, don't allow those making the purchases to know whether or not they're getting ripped off. But spare parts are just small change compared to the real moneymakers, weapons systems. The next level of Pentagon waste involves weapons we don't need at prices we can't afford, systems that, for staggering sums, fail to deliver on promises to enhance our safety and security. The poster child for such costly, dysfunctional systems is the F-35 combat aircraft, a plane tasked with multiple missions, none of which it does well. The Pentagon is slated to buy more than 2,400 F-35s for the Air Force, Marines, and Navy. The estimated lifetime cost for procuring and operating these planes, a mere $1.7 trillion, would make it the Pentagon's most expensive weapons project ever. Once upon a time, as in some fairy tale, the idea behind the creation of the F-35 was to build a plane that, in several variations, would be able to carry out many different tasks relatively cheaply, with potential savings generated by economies of scale. Theoretically, that meant the bulk of the parts for the thousands of planes to be built would be the same for all of them. This approach has proven to be a dismal failure so far, so much so that the researchers at PGO are convinced that the F-35 may never be fully ready for combat. Let's ask ourselves first if we can trust the $1.7 trillion budget estimated for the F-35. If those making such claims are as bad as those estimating the cost of our overseas military operations, the $1.7 trillion is just sort of a guess. The idea was that this aircraft could work for several different branches of the military and be something of an all-purpose aircraft. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen. And in the worst piece of news, the F-35 doesn't look like it will ever be fully ready for combat. But will the military contractors who brought us this $1.7 trillion monstrosity ever be required to refund that money to the taxpayers? They should be in jail, rather than celebrating on their yachts. Maybe flying in the air is just too tough for our military to figure out. I understand we have a commercial airline business that seems to work just fine to get people from one country to another safely. But for anything more than stable flight, maybe it doesn't get any better than a World War II P-51 Mustang. But surely, there are some branches of the military that should make us proud. How about our submarines, those silent killers of the deep, crewed by brave, smart sailors, pushing the technology to the very edge, as in the classic 1990 movie, The Hunt for Red October? According to a Newsweek magazine cover story, from April 28, 2023, our submarine program may be just as much of a mess as our aviation program. This is what they found as the result of a 3-month investigation in what may be one of the few remaining examples of genuine investigative journalism in our country. The U.S. Navy plans to expand its submarine fleet at a cost of $200 billion, equivalent to the GDP of Ukraine. But as Republicans hotly debate ongoing military aid to Kyiv, neither party has questioned the far more costly submarine program, allowing the Navy to conceal a startling fact about America's submarine fleet. The Navy calls its submarines the most lethal and capable force. It is also the silent service, shrouded in secrecy, the nature of its operations closely guarded. The American Attack Submarine Force, the Fighting Submarines, exist in order to pursue enemy submarines and ships, eavesdrop on adversaries, and support operations by special forces. Hollywood productions like The Hunt for Red October have created the impression of submarines tracking the enemy while moving noiselessly under the sea, operating stealthily for months on end. The reality is markedly different. The U.S. Navy can deploy barely a quarter of its attack submarine force at any one time. And last year, despite a war raging in Ukraine and China's rise as a global superpower, only 10% of its submarines operated stealthily by spending more than 30 days fully submerged. Our submarine force isn't a new thing like the F-35 fighter. We've had submarines since October 12, 1900, when the United States Navy launched the USS Holland more than 120 years ago. And yet, we don't seem to be able to wield it effectively as a fighting force. In the event of an actual crisis, we couldn't get more than a fourth of the fleet out in the ocean. Since our current number of submarines is 50, that means we'd only be able to get about 12 or 13 of them to where they need to go. And so much for our submarines being the silent service, when they're in that mode only about 10% of the time. The Newsweek investigation continued. The Navy's $200 billion building program is aimed at increasing the number of attack submarines from 50 to 66. That number is public. The statistic that's not discussed is that modern submarines have become so complex, the only way the Navy can appreciably increase its level of operations against Russia and China is by building many more. The Pentagon declares this an urgent task. China has the world's largest navy, and its submarine force is commonly described as catching up to the United States in quantity and quality. But as sluggish as the U.S. submarine performance is, Russia and China are even worse off. That raises further questions as to why the Navy is spending so much money in upgrading the attack submarine fleet, and in the ultimate value of such gold-plated machines. Sometimes it's difficult to escape the suspicion that all our military and civilian leaders have lost their minds. The only silver lining in all of this may be that our main adversaries, Russia and China, don't seem to be doing much better. Are we simply engaging in this madness because nobody is willing to stand up and call it out? Consider these statistics. According to secret Navy records, only 32 of 50 attack submarines deployed in 2022. Those submarines spent a cumulative 151 months at sea, a quarter of what was theoretically possible. On average, 28% of their time at sea was in transit to and from Asia and Europe, making the actual time forward deployed and on station about 107 months. In other words, less than 20% of America's attack submarines were fully deployed and fully operational at any one time during a tumultuous year. It also means that the plan to increase the number of attack submarines from 50 to 66 effectively adds only 4 deployable forward subs. I thought they were out there all the time, you know, because the Russians are coming and the Chinese military is growing, says Hans Christensen, the premier nuclear expert at the Federation of American Scientists and someone who had studied submarines for decades, commenting on Newsweek's findings. What these new numbers tell me is that the attack submarines are not war winners. These are shocking numbers and a testament to the need for good journalism. How can there be such an important issue as the reliability and usefulness of our submarine fleet, and we're so much in the dark about it? The reason is because it serves the interest of those who want us to keep shoveling money into these programs. Why are we spending $200 billion a year on a program that is not a war winner? The article concluded. There is no question that when it comes to our submarines, platform to platform, our boats are unmatchable, says a former Pentagon procurement executive. I'd say it's time to reevaluate our priorities, especially when the Ukraine war has taught us about the importance of a different kind of depth, the depth of our inventories, how voracious real war is for basic guns and ammunition, he says. We can't be so enamored of our own myths to miss this reality. Do I believe that the Newsweek reporter was the first individual to grasp the contradictions and problems with our submarine fleet? That would be madness. Instead, I believe there are many smart people involved in the defense industries who are clear-eyed about the problems, and yet their job requires them to act as if they don't see it. The incentive is to lie rather than to tell the truth, and that's why you get this behavior. However long this bad situation has been the case, that's too damn long. It might come as a surprise, given our polarized political climate, to realize that in the darkest days of World War II, politicians were celebrated for calling out waste, fraud, and abuse in the military budget, rather than being called an apologist for Hitler, Tojo, and Mussolini. In fact, it was the work Harry Truman did in the Senate, looking into military overspending during World War II, which so impressed President Franklin Delano Roosevelt that he put Truman on the ticket with him in 1944, as Roosevelt knew his own health was failing. This is from a Time magazine article on the Truman Committee from March 8, 1943. It is startling to read how good journalism once was in America, and how celebrated civic virtue was in our past. Anywhere but in a democracy, the Senate's irreverent Truman Committee would be fair game for liquidation. In a perfect state, free from butterfingers and human frailty, it would be unnecessary. In the U.S., democratic but far from perfect, the Truman Committee this week celebrated its second successful birthday as one of the most useful government agencies of World War II. Had they had time, its 10 members might have toasted their accomplishments all night. They had served as watchdog, spotlight, conscience, and spark plug to the economic war behind the lines. They had prodded Commerce Secretary Jesse Jones into building synthetic rubber plants, bludgeoned the president into killing off doddering old SPAB and setting up WPB. They had called the turn on raw materials shortages, had laid down the facts of the rubber famine 4 months before the famed Baruch Report. One single investigation of graft and waste in Army camp building had saved the U.S. $250 million, according to the Army's own Lieutenant General Brehan B. Somerville. Their total savings ran into the billions, partly because of what their agents had ferreted out in the sprawling war program, partly because their hooting curiosity was a great deterrent to waste. Can you imagine anything similar being published in today's media? It was a piece that pulsed with life and an understanding of the human condition, yet it also had an optimism that it was possible to change things for the better. The article called Truman a watchdog, spotlight, conscience, and spark plug, and made the larger picture of why, during a national emergency, it was even more important for a critic to be heard. In wartime, even more than in peace, a democracy must keep an eye on itself. This eye the Truman Committee has kept unblinkingly and, by and large, well. It has made mistakes. Some of its data have been gathered too quickly, then reduced to generalities that glittered without illuminating. Its members, including Chairman Harry S. Truman, have sometimes failed to look before they leaped to conclusions. But it has never strayed too far off the beam, nor stayed there too long. Said one Washingtonian last week, "There's only one thing that worries me more than the present state of the war effort. That's to think what it would be like now without Truman." For a congressional committee to be considered the first line of defense, especially in a nation which does not tend to admire its representatives in Congress assembled, is encouraging to believers in democracy. So is the sudden emergence of Harry Truman, whose presence in the Senate is a queer accident of democracy, as the committee's energetic generalissimo. Are these people insurrectionists? Do they genuinely believe that in a crisis situation, we should have people investigating the actions of the government and the private corporations with whom they are doing business? Don't they know that the best answer is to deplatform such critics from all media, maybe shadow ban them at the least, and engage in anonymous ad hominem attacks? Just like the health Nazis in our government got Amazon to ban books that questioned the effectiveness of masks. Where are the big pharma spinmeisters when you need them? Call in the Pfizer Brigade to counter this attack on democracy. And unlike today's media, in which anybody on your side is an exemplary human being whose perfection would be the envy of Jesus Christ himself, and the other side is a more cunning and dangerous foe than Satan, time painted Truman's career with an objective brush, especially his rise to power through the actions of the notorious Kansas City Democratic machine, headed by boss Tom Pendergast. In a perfect democracy, free from bosses string-pulling and finagling at the polls, Harry Truman would probably never have reached Washington. He was Tom Pendergast's hand-picked candidate, yanked out of obscurity so deep that few Missouri voters had ever heard of him. He was nominated over two more deserving candidates, largely by a vast plurality rolled up in boss Pendergast's Jackson County, whose registration lists were loaded with dead men or men who never lived, thanks to the boss's great power and the New Deal's 1934 popularity. His election was then automatic. No one yet knows why boss Pendergast picked Truman for the Senate. One theory: the boss was in the whimsical mood of a socialite sneaking a pet Pekingese into the social register. A better theory: the boss was impressed by the Midwestern adage that every manure pile should sprout one rose. He saw in Truman a personally honest, courageous man whose respectability would disguise the odors of the Pendergast mob. Certainly Truman was no statesman in 1934. Neither had he ever been touched by scandal. Honesty about a public figure is possible, and not just in some biography released decades after they've left the scene. In fact, it's refreshing. As the old saying goes, every saint has a past, and every sinner a future. How likely is a current mainstream media news source to describe a political figure as coming from a manure pile, and yet also having turned out to be a rose? Could we, in our modern era, discuss a political figure and say something like, "They came from a bad place, but have surprised us in a positive way with their actions," especially if that person was a white male? No, first they'd have to disclose their pronouns. We'd have to find out if they were ever a jerk to somebody in high school. And then we'd have to do a deep dive into every person they know and all the people they may have shared a stage with at one time, and then look at those individuals to see who they may know. It's like that game 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. But instead of an amusing little trivia mind-bender, it becomes the nuclear weapon with which to destroy a person's reputation. Harry Truman is an interesting example, not because he was so unique, but because his example is so common. There are lots of good people in the world trying to do the right thing in an imperfect system. More than anything, this book is for them. I spend a lot of time talking about the plans of the globalists, but I'd like people to understand that for every one globalist, there are 99 good people trying to make whatever system they're in work to the best of its capacity. If you've ever worked in a large organization, you understand there's management that proclaims the way things should be done, and then there are the workers who get things done. And every worker understands that their most important job might be to ignore the edicts of management and do the job the way it should be done for the benefit of the public. The globalists act like they're in charge, but the truth is that we are the ones in control. We just need to act like it. Because of the Truman Committee, billions of dollars were saved for the American taxpayer, and World War II was successfully fought to victory. But what happens when there are no watchdogs over government actions, and certain powerful actors are allowed to operate in the shadows? In many ways, that has precisely become the history of America since the end of the Second World War. I often speak of Eisenhower's farewell message to the American public that warned of the dangers of the military-industrial complex, but I don't think that modern audiences appreciate how radical a statement that was when the former World War II Supreme Commander announced it to the public. If a figure of such similar respect in our time made such a statement, he'd be reviled by our media and intelligence agencies as being far right, or possibly a white supremacist. This is the full text of the 10 minutes of Eisenhower's speech, delivered on January 17, 1961. My fellow Americans, 3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. Like every other citizen, I wish the new president, and all who will labor with him, Godspeed. I pray that the coming years will be blessed with peace and prosperity for all. Our people expect their president and the Congress to find essential agreement on issues of great moment, the wise resolution of which will better shape the future of the nation. My own relations with the Congress, which began on a remote and tenuous basis when, long ago, a member of the Senate appointed me to West Point, have since ranged to the intimate during the war and immediate post-war period, and finally, to the mutually interdependent during these past 8 years. In this final relationship, the Congress and the administration have, on most vital issues, cooperated well to serve the national good rather than mere partisanship, and so have assured that the business of the nation should go forward. So, my official relationship with the Congress ends in a feeling, on my part, of gratitude that we have been able to do so much together. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed 4 major wars among great nations. 3 of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely on our unmatched material progress, riches and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interest of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's adventure in free government, our basic purposes have been to keep the peace, to foster progress in human achievement, and to enhance liberty, dignity, and integrity among people and among nations. To strive for less would be unworthy of a free and religious people. Any failure traceable to arrogance, or our lack of comprehension, or readiness to sacrifice, would inflict upon us grievous hurt both at home and abroad. Progress toward these noble goals is persistently threatened by the conflict now engulfing the world, It commands our whole attention, absorbs our very beings. We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be on indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is called for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward, steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle, with liberty at stake. Only thus shall we remain, despite every provocation, on our charted course toward permanent peace and human betterment. Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. A huge increase in newer elements of our defense, development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture, a dramatic expansion in basic and applied research. These and many other possibilities, each possibly promising in itself, may be suggested as the only way to the road we wish to travel. But each proposal must be weighed in light of the broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among the national programs, balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable, balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual, balance between action of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance and progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration. The record of many decades stands as proof that our people and their government have, in the main, understood these truths and have responded to them well in the face of stress and threat. But threats, new in kind or degree, constantly arise. I mention two only. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known by any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed, by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense, as we have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security more than the net income of all United States corporations. The conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to, and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial-military posture, has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the foundation of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet, in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of a free society. Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse only to live for today, plundering, for our own ease and convenience, the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. Down the long lane of history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be, instead, a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as we do, protected by our moral, economic, and military strength. That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certain agony of the battlefield. Disarmament, with mutual honor and confidence, is a continuing imperative. Together, we must learn how to compose difference, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose. Because this need is so sharp and apparent, I confess that I'd lay down my official responsibilities in this field with a definite sense of disappointment. As one who has witnessed the horror and the lingering sadness of war, as one who knows that another war could utterly destroy this civilization, which has been so slowly and painfully built over thousands of years, I wish I could say tonight that a lasting peace is at hand. Happily, I can say that war has been avoided. Steady progress toward our ultimate goal has been made, but so much remains to be done. As a private citizen, I shall never cease to do what little I can to help the world advance along that road. So, in this last good night to you as your president, I thank you for the many opportunities you have given me for public service, in war and peace. I trust that in that service, you find something worthy. As for the rest of it, I know you will find ways to improve performance in the future. You and I, my fellow citizens, need to be strong in our faith that all nations, under God, will reach the goal of peace with justice. May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the people of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing inspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations, may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings, that those who have freedom will understand, also, its heavy responsibilities, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, that the scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made to disappear from the earth, and that, in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love. Don't you long for a time when an American president spoke with such intelligence, humility, and compassion? Eisenhower never had much of a reputation for soaring oratory, but in this farewell speech, you saw right into the soul of the man. There's no doubt in my mind that if anyone in a prominent position today, like Tulsi Gabbard, Tucker Carlson, or me, said something similar, and we have, we'd be called Putin's puppet, which has happened to each one of us. Eisenhower spoke with absolute clarity about the dangers he saw facing the country, which have now, unfortunately, all come true. In the foreign arena, he saw communism as a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Everybody understand that danger? Good. 63 years later, the Soviet Union is gone. But now China still clings to this inhuman ideology that crushes the human spirit. Let's move from the dangers outside our country to the two dangers he saw inside the country, the ways in which we might be destroyed from within. Eisenhower feared the military-industrial complex, which, through the changes in the world situation, had the potential to change us as a people. The second danger Eisenhower saw was that the country might become the captive of a scientific and technological elite. With what Eisenhower had seen in his role as president, one wonders what he might have made of the actions of Dr. Anthony Fauci and the COVID-19 task force during the COVID crisis. We may never know what President Eisenhower would have made of the actions of Dr. Fauci, but it might have resembled the scorching criticism given to these measures by one of the more conservative members of the Supreme Court, Justice Neil Gorsuch. The case in which he issued his opinion dealt with Republican states that wanted to keep Title 42, the public health policy used during the COVID crisis to turn away asylum seekers, as reported by the Daily Mail. In a statement written as part of a Supreme Court case about Title 42, Gorsuch said, "Emergency decrees were issued during the pandemic on a breathtaking scale. Governors and local leaders imposed lockdown orders, forcing people to remain in their homes. They shuttered businesses and schools, public and private," he wrote. "They closed churches, even as they allowed casinos and other favored businesses to carry on. They threatened violators not just with civil penalties, but with criminal sanctions too." One wonders where all the supposed civil libertarians were when these violations were taking place. They showed their true colors, like physically strong, but morally weak actor and former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who famously said of those who opposed the lockdown policies, "Screw your freedom." Personally, I think we should put all those public figures who didn't oppose the lockdowns under house confinement for another 2 years, or until they can pass a basic civics test on the rights guaranteed under the Constitution. The Daily Mail's report on Gorsuch's tirade continued. The justice, who was nominated to the Supreme Court by Donald Trump in 2017, gave examples of how authorities surveilled church parking lots, recorded license plates, and issued notices warning that attendance at even outdoor services satisfying all state social distancing and hygiene requirements could amount to criminal conduct. He explained how federal executive officials entered the act too, through vaccine mandates, which included threats of dismissal for employees and service members who refused. Along the way, it seems federal officials may have pressured social media companies to suppress information about pandemic policies with which they disagreed, Gorsuch added. Emergency decrees were issued at a furious pace, while Congress and state legislatures too often fell silent. This is not ancient history, like something from the 1840s, when the courts were wrestling with the issue of slavery, or the 1940s, when the Supreme Court shamefully concluded that Japanese-American citizens could be confined in internment camps, and Italian-American and German-American citizens could also be subjected to a higher level of legal scrutiny. These measures were undertaken by the supposedly most liberal members of our political community, those who push safe spaces instead of robust debates, diversity, equity, and inclusion over competence, and are in favor of lopping off the genitals of minors who lack the legal capacity to consent to even a small flower tattoo on their ankle. But even those who claim they abolished freedom in the name of safety don't have the data on their side. One review by an international team of economists found draconian shutdowns only reduced COVID mortality by 3% in the UK, US, and Europe in 2020. The experts from Johns Hopkins University in the US, Lund University in Sweden, and the Danish think tank, the Center for Political Studies, said that equates to 6,000 fewer deaths in Europe and 4,000 fewer in the United States. But official data in the U.S. has showed the country suffered nearly 300,000 more deaths than usual in more than 2 years of the pandemic that cannot be attributed to COVID. Let's leave aside for a moment the question of the genocidal campaign against the early use of therapeutics like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, the lockdowns that lowered immune function due to lack of exercise, the spiritual calm felt by going to church, vitamin D from sunlight, the lack of social connection, and the weight put on by sheltering in place. What was the strongest correlation with COVID death, whether or not you were overweight? I am specifically not raising those issues, simply noting that even by this very conservative analysis of experts, the lockdowns in the United States are implicated in at least 296,000 deaths. Despite Eisenhower's warning, we became the captives of a scientific technological elite, and, as a result, nearly 300,000 Americans lost their lives.